5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Coconuts Podcast. Today is May 13th, 2022. The Coconuts Podcast is your home for top trending news and pop culture from all across Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. From Jakarta, I'm Andrew Nazari.
And from Manila, I'm Sam Beltran.
Dark days, hey Sam, for many Filipinos.
Indeed.
I would assume.
It's like,
how you doing?
It's like we've entered a dark arc. Oh man. I don't know. Honestly, I'm in like, you know, like the five stages of grief. Right now I'm in like that weird place between, you know, between, I think I'm done with anger, as you know, probably.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So, I got a bit of that from you. Yeah.
You got a bit of that. I'm sorry.
That's a whole other story.
No, yeah, but yeah, I am in that stage, and it is really a somber time, truly, for a lot of Filipinos. You know, given the aftermath of the elections, that, you know, Bongbong Marcos is likely to really win the entire thing. And I mean, we'll get more into that a bit later. You know, we're having, you know, a political scientist coming on. His name is Cleve Arguelles, you know, to really help, you know, make sense of the entire thing and to, I guess, help a lot of people process their grief as well. Because, I mean, I can't say we haven't been expecting it, but of course, you're always hoping for the best to come out. But, you know, the writing was on the wall for a while. And I guess everybody just needs to move forward from that and really, you know, pick themselves up.
Yeah. And like I told you, as painful as it is for you and for many other Filipinos out there, you know, you're not the only ones who have experienced this post-election grief. Especially off the back of what is widely seen as an unfair result in many ways. You know, it takes time, obviously. And, you know, for progress to win, you got to play the long game. And, you know, victory may not be achieved now, but you got to do the little things so that maybe our generation and perhaps the generations that come after will reap the benefits and you know, live under a functioning democracy, so to speak.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I guess it just sucks because, you know, it means basically rewriting all of history. And this is pretty recent history, right? Like it's been less than 40 years ago. And then we're back here and it's like...
You're talking about the Marcos dictatorship, right?
Absolutely. Like the Marcos dictatorship, like we had toppled the Marcos dictatorship like 36 years ago. And now it's like we're back to square one, not having learned those lessons. But yeah, like I said, you know, and it's like you said, you know, it's all about the long game. I mean, it may be hard for a lot of Filipinos to see what, you know, what lies ahead on that road for now. But, you know, we have to get there somehow.
Yep.
Yep.
You got to crawl back up for now. But yeah, we'll talk with Cleve about that later on. But first, let's do our top stories of the week. From a man painting artwork with his peepee to alien worshippers in Bangkok, Coconuts TV brings you wacky and impactful documentaries from across the region. Don't miss out! Head down to our Coconuts TV YouTube channel to subscribe and enjoy.
So as you know, we were talking about the Philippine elections here in Manila, protesters stormed the Election Commission office amid, you know, an impending Bongbong Marcos win following reports of irregularities that took place during Monday's polls. Yeah, so demonstrations were spurred by, you know, a lot of reports regarding electoral mishaps that took place during the polls on Monday. So while Bongbong Marcos's win seems statistically inevitable, you know, as we know, he's leading now by a margin of almost 60%. A lot of Filipinos are still protesting the results because of widespread reports of malfunctioning vote counting machines where voters had lined up for over 12 hours, some even voting until well into the next day, just waiting for their ballots to be cast into a working machine, as well as reports of harassment at polling stations. So a lot of groups, they had convened near the Commission on Elections office in Manila, and they had chanted never again to martial law while decrying Bongbong Marcos and his running mate, Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte, who is President Rodrigo Duterte's daughter, as well as, you know, chanting calls against the Commission on Elections. And what was also really funny about it was that fully armed police officers had barricaded the entrance of the headquarters of the Commission on Elections, against people who were unarmed. Like, these were everyday voters who were just, you know, airing their grievances over how the whole elections had transpired. And one of them who was there is Frankie Pangilinan. So she's the daughter of Vice President Lenny Robredo's running mate, Kiko Pangilinan. So she's also the daughter of the mega celebrity Sharon Cuneta, and is also, you know, a social media influencer in her own right. And she was present at the protest. And she said that they said we have to accept defeat, that we don't know how to lose. But I think that the truth is that this is not just about this election anymore. The data clearly shows that this election was bought a long, long time ago, and that is not something we will take sitting down. I'm not going to have my president named Ferdinand Marcos again.
So yeah, I hope this doesn't escalate into violence, however angry these this large portion of Filipinos are. But Sam, could you please maybe, you know, give us a little history lesson as to what Bombo Marcos's dad, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., did all those years ago?
Yeah, so there is actually an article on the Coconuts Manila website, which is, you know, which you can see also in most of the articles related to martial law and the Marxists about, you know, about how bad, you know, the martial law regime really was. But just, you know, to give you a little bit of background. So Ferdinand Marcos Sr., so the dad of Bobo Marcos, was president of the Philippines for over 21 years. And along with the martial law regime, he had committed numerous human rights violations. And of course, his family has been proven to have plundered a lot of money. So that is, we're talking billions of dollars, to the point that they were named by the Guinness World Records as, you know, the greatest robbery by a government. So that's how bad it really was. Like, it was hundreds of billions of pesos, which, you know, translates to billions of dollars. You know, they had plundered the nation and sucked it dry. You know, a lot of people were tortured and had disappeared without a trace. And, you know, there were a lot of extrajudicial killings, and a lot of, you know, there was, you know, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended, you know. So basically they could just pick you up if you were ever suspected of, you know, being a dissident of the government without so much as having a warrant of arrest. And, you know, a lot of things happened with impunity during this period. And it's really so sad that, you know, this history is being whitewashed. Not even a mere 50 years later, like, we're talking 1986, where the People Power Revolution, where 2 million Filipinos had gone through an uprising and had ousted Ferdinand Marcos Sr. after he had rigged the snap elections that took place, which the family did. They fled Malacanang to go to Hawaii and was in hiding there. And then, you know, that's when democracy was restored, until they came back and somehow they had entered, you know, Philippine consciousness again. So we're really seeing history in the making here. We're literally seeing history being rewritten in front of our own eyes. So yeah, that's really what's ahead of the Philippines. But, you know, we'll get into that later on, you know, in during our interview with Cleve, hopefully.
Sure. Yeah. Sounds pretty depressing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, speaking of people with near absolute power, we go over to Coconuts, Bangkok, where the Royal Thai Army has banned deliveries from Lazada over a royal offense. So this week, the Royal Thai Army announced the ban because, you know, the military, which brands itself as the defenders of the crown, they waded into a scandal over a recent Lazada ad seen as mocking a royal, with Army Chief Narongpan Jit Khao Tay ordering all units to stop ordering its products for delivery to any military areas. You know, that's like the whole irony with these powerful groups and people, right? Even the smallest offenses, they get, you know, they get really, really butthurt and do things
exactly
like this. So what happened was, it was last week that a Lazada social media campaign offended people on both sides of the cultural gulf with a crude promotional TikTok that appeared to mock the disabled as well as a wheelchair-bound princess.
Which so they have in real life.
Yes, because in the ad, influencers Anuwad Nara Pratumtin and Thitupor Nurat Chowkuyang wore traditional Thai outfits with Thitupor strapped into a wheelchair. So yeah, many were offended by Thitupor's crass portrayal of the disabled, as they should be. And royalists were enraged by the likeness to Princess Chulaporn, who has lupus, and Lazada and the agency responsible for the ad have apologized. Well, what do you think? Is this reason enough for a boycott of Lazada, of the military canceling Lazada?
I don't know, man. Like, it just sounds like, you know, a bunch of army people, just like you mentioned, it's like it's getting butthurt over the tiniest thing. I mean, mm-hmm. I get it for like the disability part. Like, I get why, you know, members of the disability community or the sector would feel probably, you know, mocked at. But, you know, in terms of like the army, I mean, I feel like there's a better way to go about it. I mean, not that I'm, you know, relieving Lazada of any responsibility over this. I mean, if anything, I think that they should issue an apology regardless. But I don't know. It just sounds like banning Lazada deliveries over it just sounds a bit, you know, it sounds a bit too butthurt.
Yeah, I mean, where are the soldiers going to get their, you know, crop tops now?
Exactly.
Anywho.
Anywho.
Yeah. But yeah, moving on to Yangon now. Two journalists are now in legal limbo after spending an insane prison. So these two young journalists from Yangon news media outlet Tingyongin Post, they're still waiting for their trials to commence 9 months after they were jailed at the notorious prison. A lawyer representing Tet Tet Ang, the outlet's 30-year-old editor and co-founder Wai Lin Yu, 31, told Coconuts that the prosecutor has not even attended the pair's scheduled hearings while they languished inside the prison. You know, they cited that the court was closed due to COVID-19 regulations and all those bureaucratic nightmares. So, as you know, journalists getting arrested in Myanmar is nothing new, because, you know, as part of its campaign to stamp out resistance, the ruling junta has jailed and prosecuted dozens of reporters and prompting many to flee the country. Charges against journalists ramped up in March, and two more convictions in recent days added up to 22 reporters convicted of various charges, while 48 remain in detention. Just to highlight a recent example, a week after being found guilty of incitement, Kamayut Media co-founder Han Tar Nyein was charged with violating the electronic transactions law, which carries stiffer penalties. And Nyan Chan Wai of Bago Weekly was sentenced to 8.5 years in prison on a second conviction of incitement under the counterterrorism law, on top of a 3-year sentence he received in December. Like, seriously, man, like, this is so depressing and disheartening, especially for us in this profession.
Absolutely.
Like, these people and these reporters in Yangon unable to carry out their basic duties for fear of, like, imagine 11 years in prison just for doing your job, man. Like, that's just
exactly insane. That's like, nobody deserves that, really, and that's why democracy, guys, need to fight for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, over to Singapore, and we're back to a COVID related story. So
oh, no.
The minister of health, I know. But anyway, in Singapore, the minister of health said that contact tracing in Singapore might be re-implemented again in the future. So it's not as bad as it sounds, right? Because better to have contact tracing than none at all. So it's been 2 weeks since Singaporeans could enter most places without using the national COVID tracking systems Trace Together and Safe Entry. But the health minister warned that citizens should not delete the apps just yet, because they're taking a step down but not dismantle posture for their public health measures related to COVID, and said that in the future, if ever the situation requires it, they will have to step up and reactivate the apps. So yeah, infection rates have fallen in Singapore sharply, which is great news. But there is a new Omicron subvariant that has infected at least two people locally. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, Andra. Has the new subvariant entered Indonesia?
Apparently, yeah. But it's,
yeah, same here.
Yeah, it's nothing to be... Well, I don't want to say it's nothing to be worried about, but it hasn't led to any steep rises or anything like that so far.
Right. And I mean, we don't know much about it, and neither does Singapore. And, you know, the health officials in Singapore have said that they're working to figure out whether it's more infectious or whether it's tameable with existing vaccines. So, yeah, basically, he just wants people of Singapore to stay on their toes. And Singapore is recording a 7-day average of just more than 3,500 new daily cases, which was a huge drop from their peak in February of nearly 20,000. And hospital resources are basically operating at a more normal pace now. And there are more than enough beds to accommodate anybody who might be infected with the virus. And yeah. The unvaccinated, so good news for Miss Iris Cole, I guess, probably, because they're now allowed to enter malls. Exactly, yeah, I mean, anti-vaccine.
It hasn't been that much of a bother for me to take out my phone and for the tracing app, right? But
right,
I guess I in this story anyway. When I first read it, I was like, "Oh shit, are we seeing another wave?" In the region, but thankfully not. I think they're just being cautious.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really great about Singapore is that they've always taken that endemic approach to the whole COVID thing. So it's not like they imagine it to be gone anytime soon, but they're going to have to want to return to a semblance of normalcy, which is great for them because, I mean, they have the resources to manage that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but basically, guys, if you're living in Singapore, don't delete those apps just yet, because you never know.
But hopefully they'll never have to use it again.
Absolutely. I mean, I hope nobody else has to use it.
Anywho, from COVID, we go to homophobia.
Oh, God.
And no prizes for guessing which country I'm talking about here.
Oh, me. Is it Jakarta?
Yeah, well, yes, Indonesia. Specifically, Coconuts Jakarta, where we reported that this podcaster, like one of the most popular podcasts in Indonesia, he had to take down a recent episode featuring a gay couple, a gay married couple, amid a huge national backlash.
What? Wow. Really?
Yeah. So this dude, Deddy Corbusier, interesting name, interesting fella. He was a magician who became like a sort of TV personality and then became a podcaster. His podcast is seriously like for like very Joe Rogan-esque.
Interesting. Have you taken a listen?
Oh God, no. for the purposes of research for the article, yes. But basically, he invites people from all walks of life, you know, some more controversial than others, to his show where they talk for 2 or 3 hours about, you know, all sorts of topics. You know, sounds very familiar, right?
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
And like even the whole set is basically the Joe Rogan podcast. Like if you watch the YouTube version of his podcast episodes. Anyway.
Yep.
On May 7th. Deddy published an episode which was crudely and sensationalistically titled Tutorial on Being Gay in Indonesia. And in that episode, in that episode, he welcomed married gay couple Ragil Mahardika and his German partner, Frederick Wuller, for the interview. And what followed was swift condemnation from homophobes, including from the country's top religious authorities. And there were massive calls for boycott of Deddy's podcast, and including the hashtag unsubscribe podcast Corbusier, which trended for days this week. So we noticed that on YouTube, anyway, his subscriber count decreased by at least 100,000 from like 18.7 million to 18.6 million just within a day after this podcast was posted on YouTube. But more interestingly is that I wouldn't know. I don't follow Deddy Corbusier on Instagram, but local media outlets reported that before the episode aired, he had some 20 million followers on Instagram. But the day after the episode aired, he was down to 11.1 million.
That is a lot of people who unsubscribed.
Yeah, meaning he lost, you know, some 9 million followers on Instagram.
And million homophobes.
Oh my God. If you put it that way, it's like if 20 million were a sample of Indonesia, representing Indonesia, that means like at least half of us.
Exactly, are homophobes.
Oh my God. But that prompted him, Daddy Corbusier, to take down the video, which is quite unprecedented for his podcast. And he quoted, and he said in an apology post, he said, "As usual, with all the unrest on social media, I apologize. From the beginning, I said I don't support LGBT acts." What are exactly LGBT acts anyway? Anyway, and he goes on to say, "I only see them as humans." And then he went on to say, "I'm taking down the video, but I still believe they're human. I hope they will find a better way. Sorry for all."
What does that even mean? Hope they will find a better way.
I don't know. It means that maybe he's feeling the brunt of, I'm guessing, the economic brunt of losing all those followers.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That he had to take this measure.
I've only heard of Daddy Corbusier, however you pronounce it, today. Mm. I'm guessing he's like one of those, you know, like those people who make money out of sensationalism. Like he's probably one of those like controversial figures who, you know, who like to rile up people on purpose, which is why, honestly, I have no sympathy for this dude based on the story alone. I mean, I'm sorry if that sounds a bit harsh, but I mean, of course, I don't think that, you know, the LGBT couple that he featured deserve the hate directed towards them. But even how he was planning to use the couple, you know, for his own selfish means, just to rile up, you know, a reaction out of people, just to incite a reaction out of people. Like, that's not even something that I'm really for. And as much as, you know, I mean, there's a lot of sides. I mean, on one hand, it really sucks that half of his followers are huge homophobes. But on the other hand, I mean, dude, you kind of deserve it. So,
yeah. And you mentioned the negativity towards the gay couple in the episode. Right. One of them, the Indonesian guest Ragil, he's actually been quite famous for documenting his married life.
Wow.
On TikTok especially. He's been doing so since 2018. And amid all this controversy, he posted on Instagram that, you know, all this hatred is par for the course for him, especially when he began to gain a following for documenting his life as a married gay man on social media. And then, you know, but in the end, he's not bothered by any of this. He stoically said, "One thing you must know, there is more than just one Ragil. There are many more Ragils out there, even your friends, best friends, family, or your partner, because many of you get married to women to attain a fake status."
That sounds about right.
Yep. And he says, "You can turn a blind eye to us, but know that we live among you. Like it or not, we exist." Yeah.
Wow. Strong words. But yeah, couldn't have said it better myself.
And speaking of, we're going to remain in Indonesia with another story that's related to, equality, so to speak. Tragically, an Aussie model and a marriage equality campaigner by the name of Ryan Channing has passed away in Bali.
Oh, that's so sad.
If you don't know who he is, he's a skincare entrepreneur in Australia. And he's perhaps best known within the LGBTQIA+ community in Down Under as a prominent campaigner for marriage equality, along with his ex-boyfriend, who is retired swimmer and Olympic gold medalist Ian Thorpe.
Damn.
So we don't know. I mean, local authorities in Bali have not reported about his death, and we don't know what exactly happened, but Ryan Channing's family has confirmed his tragic passing, and his brother Jake has confirmed to us of that fact. And he shared an Instagram post in which he said, "As we seek answers and try to come to terms with the heartbreaking loss of my beautiful big brother, we ask for your prayers, support, and privacy." So yeah, Channing's family has not disclosed his cause of death either, but Jake noted in the post that he shared with us that Ryan did not die of COVID-19, as has been rumored, especially in Australia, because his last Instagram post, dated March 10th, showed him at a Sydney hospital being treated for the disease.
Damn.
Just this is a big loss for, you know, for LGBTQIA rights, because you know Ryan Channing, who founded skincare brand BLAQ in 2016, he and Thorpe campaigned for marriage equality during the 2017 Australian Marriage Law Postal Survey, and same-sex marriage became legal in Australia in December of that year. So yeah, he's done quite a lot for the rights. Yeah.
And he's such a visible figure. I mean, it's definitely such a loss. And, you know, it's always sad to see somebody gone too soon.
Yeah, 32.
Shit. So from Bali, we go over to Hong Kong, where scalpers have jacked up the band Mirror's concert tickets to as high as 438,102 Hong Kong dollars, which is equivalent to $54,780 US dollars for a single ticket. So that is crazy high.
Who is Mirror?
So Mirror is a popular boy band in, you know, I mean, like, you know how there's like K-pop and everything. And, you know, I mean, of course, you know, Hong Kong needs to have its own answer. So basically Mirror is its answer to probably BTS or all the big boy bands that are coming out of, you know, out of K-pop. So they are a huge Cantopop boy band, and they were formed through a reality talent show called Goodnight Show Kingmaker, which I am guessing is probably close to something like X Factor. So they have 12 members. So they're a huge deal in Hong Kong, which is why, you know, these unscrupulous touts have thought to jack up prices to as high as that. Because, you know, you see people willing to pay, to shell out probably for those prices. And while, of course, it is a crime in Hong Kong to resell tickets for such astronomical prices, you know, these scalpers are met with a mere fine of 2,000 Hong Kong dollars. So they're willing to take a risk to make a quick profit. Because, I mean, what's $2,000, right? Out of like a 55,000 US dollar ticket, almost. And, you know, they're meeting a lot of crazy demand. And police, in fact, just arrested a man on Sunday on suspicion of selling two fake concert tickets to the Cantopop sensation show for 10,000 Hong Kong dollars. That's equivalent to 1,274 USD. Because of course, what's worse than, you know, than really high concert tickets, highly priced concert tickets? Probably fake, highly priced fake concert tickets, right? So Mirror just announced that they will be holding 10 shows at the Hong Kong Coliseum, with tickets priced originally at 480 Hong Kong dollars. That's equivalent to 61 USD, 880 Hong Kong dollars, equivalent to 112 USD, and 1,280 Hong Kong dollars, which is equivalent to 163 US dollars, which is, you know, if you're seeing these crazy highly priced tickets, that is a huge leap for sure. And
yeah, while organizers still expensive on their own.
They are on their own. But I mean, seriously, 54,000 something US dollars, that is crazy high. And the kicker here is that the organizers have yet to announce details of public sales, but there was priority booking for credit card holders of Cities the Club on April 29, and tickets sold out in less than an hour. So we can guess how these, you know, how these scalpers got a hold of these tickets. So yeah, so tickets to the July 30 show, for example, can be found being sold at 438,102 Hong Kong dollars, which is equivalent to 55,811 USD for a single ticket on the reseller platform Viagogo. Yeah, so the seller claims that they are for first row seats with unrestricted views, although we weren't able to verify whether that was really, you know, that's really true.
You know, scalpers have bad reps already, but this whole thing reflects even more badly on them. Get it?
Yeah. Took me a while, to be honest. Took me a second. I know it took me a second, but yeah, fair point. Fair point. Definitely. I mean, it really sucks because, I mean, let people enjoy what they want, right? Just let people enjoy things. Don't ruin it with like crazy yeah. scalping schemes.
For the record, fuck scalpers.
Absolutely. Fuck scalpers. Have you ever had to buy a ticket from a scalper?
Oh, God, no. I will not enable them in any way.
Same here. Absolutely.
If I don't I don't score tickets, then I don't score tickets. That's it.
Exactly. That's it.
That's my thing.
Oh, God. Agreed.
All right, Sam. As promised earlier in a rather depressing intro segment of this podcast episode, we are going to go deeper into the Filipino election and at the aftermath with our interview segment coming up.
Huge news for the Philippines this week. You know, as you probably know, Andra, we just concluded the Philippine elections this Monday, and you know, it's an interesting development, especially since, you know, the son of former dictator and former president Ferdinand Marcos, Bongbong Marcos, is expected to win the elections. And here to talk to us more about the aftermath of the elections is Clive Arguelles. He is an assistant professorial lecturer at De La Salle University at the Department of Political Science. Clive, thank you so much for making time to join us and chat with us about, you know, about pretty much what transpired this week.
Hi, Sam and Andra. Happy to be here, although I'm not happy to talk about what happened in the Philippines.
Yeah, I wish we were meeting under better circumstances, but you know, here we are, and thank you for helping us to make sense of this, you know, of this development, especially, you know, with the regional audience.
Right. Speaking of regional context, I guess the non-Filipino here in the room would like to ask the first question with regards to the election first. So, Clive, are the results still in doubt in any way, or are we, that's it, or we're going to have 6 years of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. In charge?
Right. Thanks, Andra. I think at this point, we know that we're going to have 6 years of another Marcos presidency in the Philippines. So the official counting is still not over. So the election authorities are still doing the official certification of the election returns. But we've already seen in the unofficial servers, in the unofficial counts, and this is also the same number, if there are no problems, this is also the same number that they will certify later on, that Ferdinand Marcos Jr., as well as his vice presidential candidate, Mayor Sara Duterte, the daughter of the incumbent president, Rodrigo Duterte, is set to become the president and vice president for the next 6 years. And they have actually won with a very historic mandate. Marcos Jr. is the first president since his father, so since the end of the dictatorship, to have win a majority, if not more than the majority of the votes. So this clearly is a turning point for the country.
So we're looking at nearly 60% for Bongbong. Is that correct?
Yes, as of now, yes.
Wow.
Goodness. Okay, you know, as you mentioned, Clive, it's a turning point for the Philippines. What would you attribute Bongbong's imminent victory to?
I think there are three very important factors at play here, how they were able to secure this landslide electoral victory. First is that this is the 2022 Philippine elections is by all intents and purposes a continuity election. The incumbent president, Rodrigo Duterte, while he did erode democracy and human rights in the country, and he also had problems managing the pandemic response of the government, he's ending his term as among the most popular of all Philippine presidents compared to the past Philippine presidents. And most Filipino voters have actually have a very positive assessment of his administration, and they continue to support him. And this particular popularity of the incumbent president is driving that demand for a presidential candidate who can continue his legacies and his policies. Mm. In fact, we did a survey in the October of 2021, and we found out that most Filipino voters, around 70%, wanted a continuity of the Duterte projects and policies, and would likely use that particular criterion to look for their next president. And definitely, the Marcos Duterte tandem, they've clearly positioned themselves as the continuity candidates. I mean, it's not very difficult, especially that Duterte's daughter is running with Marcos, and Marcos Jr. is also in a coalition, in the current administration coalition with President Duterte. The other reason, I think, how we got here has something to do with the role of disinformation. So it wasn't all of about Rodrigo Duterte. So the Marcos family invested in a massive online disinformation machinery as early as 6 years ago, and they reaped the benefits of that investment in this particular elections. So pro-Marcos propaganda have dominated social media platforms, especially those who are especially platforms which are popular to Filipino voters like Facebook and YouTube. And I think I'm not alone here. Probably, some have also encountered these kinds of propaganda videos, photos, stories, no? And
oh, sure.
Yes, right. And so many of the voters of Marcos Jr., because of these disinformation campaigns, they think that the Philippine martial law years was the country's golden era. It was the golden era of Philippine infrastructure, and that the plunder of state resources and all of the corruption and human rights abuses during that time, that these are all just fake news, and they're nothing but black propaganda. So the disorganized disinformation campaigns by the Marcos family really benefited them for this particular election, and it was really unfortunately effective. And the last thing I think the last major factor that I think played a role in this result that we are seeing is the role of the political marriage of these two families, the Marcos and Duterte. And they also, this particular alliance of these two political families also include other influential political dynasties, including some of the most entrenched and influential political bosses in the country. For example, former President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo and former President Joseph Estrada. If you will, actually, if you will think about it, most of the politically active first families are actually part of this coalition. And what this means for the election is that this alliance was able to significantly concentrate political resources, including election machines, for example, which is very important when it comes to Philippine elections. It's through these election machines where you can distribute cash, where you can build a network of voters, grassroots voters, as well as control the turnout in your particular areas. And for some of these families included in the alliance, actually for most of these families included in the alliance, they have been in control of their provinces, for some of them for more than 5 decades now, or even longer, including definitely the Marcos and Duterte families, who controls Ilocos Norte and Davao City respectively. So
I imagine it would be pretty near impossible to turn against that tide. And it's pretty disheartening to hear that their propaganda machine, in which they invested heavily into, worked basically. They're reaping the benefits now. But on the election day itself, there are also numerous reports of irregularities, right? Like machines breaking down, people being unable to vote until well into the next day. These kind of things have sowed distrust in the electoral process amongst some people in the Philippines. Is that, do you think, a fair observation, or are people simply feeding into their biases here?
I think it's fair to say that we've really faced significant difficulties, like ordinary voters face significant difficulties for these particular elections, especially when you compare it to the past automated election. So around 1,800 of the vote counting machines malfunctioned. And this affected between 1 to 2 million voters. So it may be small compared to the rest of the voting population, around 65 million, for example. But this is still 1 to 2 million of your voters who decided to, you know, to show up on the polling booth, but wasn't able to vote because of the failures of these vote counting machines, for example. So I was poll watching during the night of the election. So the election should have ended, the voting should have ended by 7 p.m. of that day, 7 in the evening of that day. But in the precincts that we have been poll watching for, we ended the voting by 4 in the morning the following day. And that's because the vote counting machine malfunctioned at the beginning of the day after, like, you know, around 30 votes. And then it only got replaced around 12 midnight of that day. And, you know, this is not unique to our case.
Yeah.
As I said, there are 1,800 of these cases. You can just imagine for these voters, I would tend to think that it would be quite reasonable for them to feel a certain level of distrust on the results of the elections. But having said that, I so far, looking at the transmission, looking at the election returns as we speak, there are also manual audits of the ballots, random manual audits of the ballots and the election returns. And so far, we have no credible evidence to say that there was a massive election fraud or election cheating. What we can say so far is that at least what we've witnessed during the election day is incompetence on the part of the election authorities in terms of preparing for these elections.
Right.
I think that brings us nicely to the next question, Cleve. Since you mentioned that there is no credible evidence that electoral fraud did take place and that Bongbong is easily leading by 60%, would you say that on a level playing field, would Vice President Leni Robredo have stood a chance? Or is the gap between her and Bongbong Marcos's votes too insurmountable to overcome?
Right. So, yeah. Well, as you've said, really, the margin is quite huge. I think that's around 12 million votes between the second placer, Vice President Leni Robredo, and current frontrunner Ferdinand Marcos Jr. I think it's important to take a look at how much usually winning presidents get in Philippine elections. And it's usually, you know, since we have returned and restored democracy in the country in 1986, in those past presidential elections, most of the winning presidents would only get around 39%. So most of the Philippine presidents who were elected actually didn't get any of the majority vote. So for political observers like me, for example, we have long considered 39% as sort of like the magic number for those who are running for the presidency. So if you run a presidential campaign, you actually make a plan to, you actually try to come up with a plan to get 39% of the votes on election day. And that's been the usual practice. That's usually what's expected. So if that were the case, Leni Robredo actually is around 28 to 29% right now in the partial and official results. So she would still have lost the elections if she would have maintained that particular numbers, at least if we see it that way. But I think it's also important to point out that Vice President Leni Robredo, really, this was really an uphill battle for her because she was the target of the organized disinformation campaigns as far back as 6 years ago. And she was also a constant target of the highly popular incumbent president. So the way I see it, it has always been a very difficult election for her to begin with.
I see. Well, I'm going to ask you to look ahead then for the Philippines. So I imagine that this kind of election has so divisions in the country. But do you think ahead, can the country reconcile, or will we see deeper divisions in society after the election?
Hey. So as a Filipino, I would like to say that I hope that I hope that we can move forward as a country with this particular results. But as a political observer, I actually think that we may expect political instability in the coming years on the part of the Philippines. And since we have audience from all across the region, I think a good example might be Thailand and how in the recent years they have become more or less really polarized, right, in different camps. And I think that's also something that's going to happen in the Philippines in the coming years, because there is really a dedicated anti-Marcos constituency among Filipinos, especially those who have supported the candidacy of Vice President Lenny Robredo. And it's sizable, as you know, it's around 30% of the country saying that they could not accept the presidency of Marcos Jr. And it's not as if this is just, you know, political infighting, or that they couldn't really accept political defeat. But because the electoral victory of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. also represents, as I've said, a turning point in the country's history because of their family's role, including Ferdinand Marcos Jr., in the human rights abuses and corruption, among the world's worst cases of corruption. And they're about to run the government again. So you can imagine that even at this early time, even if, you know, they have yet to occupy their seats, people on the ground, the opposition are already considering what they would do to actually ensure that the Marcos family will have a hard time committing the same corruption and human rights abuses that they have committed when they were in power more than 3 decades ago.
But is it reasonable to hope that there won't be any, this won't spill over into violence in the maybe months, weeks and months ahead?
Right. Compared to the neighbors of the Philippines in the region, I think one of the unique characteristics of Philippine politics is that we have very little election-related violent mobilization in okay. our country's political history. So if that's an indication, then we hopefully we wouldn't see any violent mobilizations around these election results. But this could always change because, as I've pointed out, these particular elections also deviated from what was traditional and what was usually expected in Philippine elections. So you could also imagine that the people in the other camps are probably also considering new ways, never been tried, never been tested ways to contest the new government.
Let's hope it doesn't lead into bloodshed. But, you know, that really tests the whole campaign idea behind the Bongbong Marcos and Sara Duterte tandem, you know, the whole unity theme that they have. You know, moving on, Cleve, I wanted to pick your brain on whether you agree with the sentiment that Bongbong's victory is a setback for Filipino democracy. What are your thoughts?
I definitely think that it represents a significant setback for Philippine democracy, precisely because the story of, you know, the past 35 years is a story of our attempt to rebuild, still rebuilding Philippine democracy from how the Marcos family destroyed it during the 20 plus years that they were in power as dictators, right? So now that the Filipino voters have are about to return the family, about to send back the family to Malacañang, then it really puts into question what the country was doing in the past decades, right? If you just look at the 1987 constitution, the current constitution, just also look at what are the significant national celebrations that we have, for example, in the current political arrangement. And all this has something to do with the ouster of the end and the fall of the Marcos dictatorship. So this particular restoration of the Marcos family actually, I think, represents that triumph of the old families in the Philippines. So continues to insist that democracy cannot work in the Philippines, and that the better path for the country is towards something more authoritarian, if not liberal.
Oh gosh. What are your thoughts, Cleve? Can the Philippines bounce back once we head down that road?
On this note, I'd probably be pessimistic on this note. I think it takes a while. I think it's from my perspective, and I also do a study of political attitudes of generations. I think it will take a generation before we get back to the path towards democracy again. In the sense that if you will look at the results of this election, it appears that there's a cross-section of Filipino voters, you know, no matter the class, no matter the age, no matter the gender, appears to support the campaign of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. And if you look at how long they were able to rule the country, around 20 plus years in their first administration, and definitely they're wiser, they're stronger this time around. I think it might take a while before Filipinos realize that this isn't really the path that they want to take.
Is there a risk or a chance for Bongbong Marcos, you know, with all this huge victory that he just enjoyed? Could he impose, I don't know, maybe some constitutional changes that would extend his time in power just like his daddy did? Basically, right. Can we have another period of like a true dictatorship under him?
Yeah. Really good question, Andrea. I think that's actually one of the expectations of many political observers, that because of this historic number of votes that they were able to mobilize, that it will probably be used to legitimize and justify constitutional changes, significant changes in the current political setup. So it's important also to note that many of the leaders of the coalition, for example, former President Arroyo, former President Estrada, also incumbent President Rodrigo Duterte, for example, they have repeatedly in the past attempted to change the constitution, but they were constrained because they didn't have the support of the majority. So now that they no longer have that kind of constraint, we can expect and can imagine that they will probably put into action their plans to change the constitution. And one or two of the directions that has always been in consideration for this particular coalition of families is to shift to a federal system. And that means giving more control to the local political bosses, local political dynasties, being in control of their provinces, and really have them, sort of like kings and queens of their own kingdoms, right?
Jeez.
The other route is a shift to a parliamentary system. This has also been part of the playbook, especially of former President Arroyo. And the idea there is that they will no longer be constrained with absolute term limits and probably wouldn't have a problem being in power for far longer than 6 years. So regardless of the changes that they will institute, regardless of what new arrangement they would propose, it's a worrying, it would be a worrying development for the country, because given the current numbers, it also means that the opposition, democracy and human rights advocates would probably be unable to generate enough mobilization to counter these kinds of moves.
Yeah, that sounds pretty dystopian and scary. But, that's probably kind of still pretty far off in the future, right? But if we look at the imminent future, as soon as Bongbong takes office, what does the imminent future hold for the Philippines under Marcos Jr. presidency? Because I've been hearing a lot that Bongbong was pretty much, you know, an absentee governor and senator. During his time in those seats, like will we also see an absentee president in terms of, you know, major policies?
My answer is actually close to what you've said, Andre. I think my expectation is that Ferdinand Marcos Jr. will probably end up as an unremarkable president. Despite this historic mandate and despite this very significant electoral victory, only and I'm saying this because, as Andrea pointed out, in the past, it's been a ghost politician, an absentee senator, an absentee governor, and you know, we can expect that he will be an absentee president. But that doesn't mean that you know, a Marcos, an unremarkable Marcos presidency doesn't mean that it won't be dangerous for the country and for many Filipinos. It will still be because a ghost president would only mean that it's the people around him who would likely make the decisions and who would likely run the government. And from what we've seen so far, the people around him are not really exactly also good actors, for example, or, you know, they don't really have exactly good track records, for example, in Philippine politics. So former President Gloria Arroyo is one of the most unpopular presidents in Philippine history because of allegations of election cheating, which she apologized for on nationwide television, but refused to resign. And former President Joseph Estrada, for example, was kicked out of power in a people power mobilization because of being involved in corruption, in large-scale corruption in the Philippine government. So these are the people who will likely be in charge of the Marcos Jr. Government.
Cleve, I wanted to ask you because, you know, it's been all over the headlines. Like, for example, JP Morgan dropped the Philippines at the bottom of the ASEAN investment. And, you know, a lot of people have been, you know, they have doubts over what effect a Bongbong Marcos presidency would have on the economy. Could you care to weigh in on the economic standing and the international standing the Philippines would possibly face under President Bongbong Marcos?
Right. I have two things to say about this question. One is that I wouldn't be surprised if there is a negative response coming from the market, both domestic and internationally. Well, because the history of the Marcos family, the first Marcos administration, doesn't really speak well about how they have treated the economy, right? So if that's an indication, then I think the worry of our market players, our investors, is that if they would just repeat what they did in the first Marcos administration, that would mean that they will be rewarding their cronies, that a big segment and a big part of the economy will be in control of their allies, and that a significant amount as well of the economic resources would be plundered by the family. Again, that assumption there is that if they would be doing exactly what they did in the first Marcos administration, right? But the second thing is that, well, we actually don't know what they're going to do. Part of this, why we don't know, is because Ferdinand Marcos Jr. Never really talked about any of his plans in the campaign trail. He has repeatedly evaded presidential debates. He continues to refuse to talk to the media. So we are actually forced to speculate and forced to be in the dark because there's really no accurate and timely information being released to the public about his economic plans, for example. And if I were a foreign investor, I own a small business in the Philippines, I think that period that I don't know what's going to happen in the next 6 years, you know, is it really something that would inspire confidence on my part to continue doing business in the country, right? So I think that's also another angle, that even if their worry is not really that they would that the Marcos Jr. administration would repeat the Marcos Sr. administration, I think the worry is that there's not enough information going around that would be helpful for investors and businesses to plan their next 6 years.
Okay, wow, so to think that this guy got 60%, huh?
Exactly. <Pretty amazing. laughs> Yeah. But, you know, that's a whole other thing to unpack, really. And I think that deserves on its own, you know, a separate episode to really dig into. But, you know, I guess to close, Cleve, let's, since, you know, we're speculating here anyway, let's speculate a little bit more. What would you say would be the hallmarks of a successful presidency for Bongbong Marcos?
I think a successful Marcos presidency would mean that they have delivered on what their voters have associated with the Marcos family brand. So big on infrastructure projects, big on debt-driven social welfare programs, for example, and also big on anti-communist, kind of like pro-Philippine security defense policy kind of like agenda. So I think if the incoming president, Marcos Jr., will be able to deliver on these three things, I think that there will, it's likely that they will have another shot at the presidency 6 years after.
Yikes.
Goodness. And you know, I'm pretty sure it also comes with the, you know, with the image of keeping up, you know, with the Gilded Age of the Marcoses, so to speak.
Right. You know, we have a new first family. We have a new royal family, if you will. And if you have been seeing how the Marcos Jr. family has been conducting themselves in public, in campaign rallies, they really behave like, you know, they're the newest royal family of the country. And yeah, so it's very likely that we will also be seeing more of their faces in the coming years.
Wonderful. on that note, thank you so much, Clee, for coming on to the Coconuts Podcast to share with us your insights and for your time, of course. Yeah.
Thank you for helping.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for helping me process my my grief.
All right, you take care now.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, Andra, you already know my thoughts on the matter, right? And if anything, Cleve just really confirmed my worst fears about what, you know, what the Philippines likely faces in, you know, in the event of a Marcos presidency. But what about you? What are your takeaways from the whole thing?
I don't know. I'm just hoping, like, the whole ghost president thing, I'm just hoping that he would be so inept and so uncaring, so disinterested while he's in office that it doesn't really have that much of an effect on the general Filipino populace. But as Cleve mentioned earlier, that might be wishful thinking.
That would be best case scenario.
Yeah, I'm just hoping for best for you and everybody else there.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, all that's really left there is to do is, you know, I mean, wishing the Philippines good luck in the coming years.
Absolutely.
And I mean, those feeling, you know, those who are against this, you know, this turn of democracy should really, you know, pick themselves up and get to work, really, I think.
Yeah, the work starts again now.
Absolutely.
And on that note, that is it for the Coconuts Podcast this week. We hope to see you again same time next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to support Coconuts and our weird and wondrous stories, you can become a Coco Plus member at coconuts.co/membership, make a patron payment at coconuts.co/patron, or buy your fresh merch at the Coconut Shop at shop.coconuts.co.
Advertise with our in-house agency, Grove. Fast, funny, digital. Join forces with us to slay buzzwords, rise above the noise, and sow the seeds of something great. Get in touch via coconuts.co/grove.
Subscribe to the podcast and leave reviews. Tell us how you feel and what you like and don't like. We're excited to hear from you.
The Coconuts Podcast delivers impactful, weird, and wondrous reporting by our journalists on the ground in 8 cities: Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Manila, Jakarta, Kuala Lumpur, Yangon, and Bali. Listen to headline news and insightful interviews on matters large and small, designed for people located in or curious about Southeast Asia and Hong Kong.
The Coconuts Podcast is a Coconuts Media production. Our hosts are Sam Beltran and Andra Nasri. Our executive producer is Byron Perry. Our production manager is Clarissa Cortez. And our editor is Paul Medina.